Sometimes life deals us a blow. How we experience adversity and emerge from it is the subject of our conversations today. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Today we visit with two Sonoma County writers who bring their stories to us. In just a moment, we'll speak with journalist, blogger, and graphic artist Brian Fees on his graphic memoir, A Fire Story. Brian has been drawing comics for just about his whole life and has two other graphic books before this depiction of his experience losing his home in the North Bay fires of 2017. Later in the broadcast, we'll visit with R.L. Rotary, survivor of childhood sexual abuse, who has emerged from that horrendous experience with grace and wit and tells the story in her memoir, The Little Girl Next Door. Stay with us. It is a novel idea. On a warm, windy night in October of 2017, a fast-moving fire crossed the Mayacamas Mountains and descended out of the wildlands and into urban Santa Rosa, California, and incinerated thousands of structures in a matter of hours, one of which was the home of Brian Fees and his family. Fees had previously published a graphic memoir depicting his family's journey through his mom's cancer, in the publication Mom's Cancer, as well as the graphic novel Whatever Happened to the World of Tomorrow. So an initial inclination for him was to just start drawing. Let's listen to our conversation. Brian Fees, welcome to talk to us today about your book, A Fire Story.
Thanks so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Your book is a graphic memoir, and it tells the story of the loss of your home, the disappearance of your home in the North Bay fires, and the trajectory through that process. And we're going to get to talking about A Fire Story in just a minute, but I would like to know a little bit more about you, and I think our listeners and readers would as well, because you have a couple other books.
I do.
And they are graphic books too. Cartoons is the word that I use. I don't know if that's the...
Oh, we can call them comic books. I'm not too snooty about it.
Okay. All right. And when did you start cartooning?
Well, like every cartoonist I know, I started when I was 2 years old. It took me many decades after that to figure out how to make any money at it. But it was always a hobby, one I occasionally pursued very seriously. But it's also a very hard one to make money at, make a living at. So I did other things. I've been a newspaper reporter. I've been an environmental chemist. I've been a science writer and a freelance magazine writer. But all through that time, I always kept cartooning and occasionally sold a little thing here or there, but kept my skills up, kept working on it until when I was in my mid-40s, my mother was diagnosed with cancer. And I knew I wanted to tell our family's story somehow. You know, we kept, even though one of my sisters is a registered nurse, we kept getting hit by surprises, things that astonished us about this cancer experience. And so I wanted to share that with people. I wanted to draw a roadmap for people coming behind us. And I wasn't sure how to do that until one day I took my mom to chemotherapy. And she's sitting in the chair, and it's a boring process. She's basically napping for a couple of hours while she gets the chemo. And I turned a piece of paper over, and I drew a sketch of her sitting in the chair. And I put some little labels around it about not just the ideal cocktail she was taking, but the fast food milkshake she had on the nightstand by her. And I realized that in that one picture, I'd captured more about what that day was like than I could have done in 3,000 words of prose. So I decided then I was going to tell our family story in the form of a comic, a graphic novel. So I made first a web comic, and then later on a published book called Mom's Cancer. And that got some notice and won some awards and sold a few copies and is actually still in print years later and is taught in medical school, which certainly wasn't my intent, but means...
Well, that's what I found interesting about what I've been exposed to in that book and in A Fire Story as well, is the ability to take these very troubling and deeply personal and emotional episodes in your life, which are things that many of us experience in our own lives, and bring this form that we associate with, I mean, they're called comics,
yeah,
you know, and a lightness that somehow maybe diffuses fear or demystifies things, brings it down to something very elemental.
That's precisely right. That's a really nice way to put it, you know, and it's a strange idea to someone who maybe the last comic they read was Casper the Friendly Ghost when they were 8 years old. They think comics are juvenile and they think they should be funny. And I'm a messenger of the message that comics are, they're a medium. They're not a genre. A comic can be fiction or nonfiction, can be serious or funny, can be adult or juvenile. There's nothing wrong with funny comics for kids, but that's not all there is. And I also think that there's something about the comics medium, about the combination of words and pictures, that lends itself to this sort of memoir. I mean, all the most successful graphic novels, Mouse by Art Spiegelman, Persepolis, Fun Home, they're all memoirs. And I think that is partly because of exactly what you said, is what a graphic novel does, what a comic of any sort does, is it distills an experience, it distills reality down to just its essence, down to just the bare information needed to convey what that experience was like. And I think that's how people's memories work. You know, when you remember, when you think back in your own mind to something that happened to you, you don't remember, it's not a photographic record. You don't remember what color the curtains were. You remember who was there and what happened and how it made you feel. That experience distilled to its essence. And a good comic does the same thing. It just strips away all the extraneous stuff and just delivers that one little piece of truth about what that moment was like.
So Mom's Cancer is mm-hmm. the story of your family and your mother's cancer.
Yes.
And you followed that with another book, Whatever Happened to the World of Tomorrow?
Yes.
You want to talk about that for a minute?
I'd love to, because it's so near and dear to my heart. Whatever Happened to the World of Tomorrow is the book I would have written if I'd never done Mom's Cancer. It's a book about being a space-age kid, growing up I remember the Apollo program, getting to be the age I am now and wondering, where's my flying car and why am I not living on the moon? And it's kind of a pop culture. It's a comic book, so it's through the lens of comics and pop culture. But it's a look at how America went from the idea that tomorrow would be better than today to kind of this pessimistic dystopianism. How do we go from utopianism to dystopianism? How did scientists go from the good guys to the bad guys? How do we get from Flash Gordon to Blade Runner, you know? And that's kind of what that book's about. It starts at the 1939 World's Fair, which in my opinion, and it's not an original idea, was sort of America's first look at a unified tomorrow, at a real future. People saw their first fax machines and robots and televisions at the 39 World's Fair. Some people saw their first electric lights coming in off the farm. And so I start with that as a unified vision of how wonderful tomorrow could be and kind of take it through the 70s to when we seem to have lost faith. I'm hoping to kind of give some illumination as to why that might have happened.
Well, then I feel I must take a look at that book. How did that happen? You know, we were so excited about what was coming before us.
Well, to give away the end of the book, I sort of conclude that we got an amazing future. It just wasn't the one we expected. We didn't get flying cars, but we got computers with, you know, the power of all the information in the world in our pockets. That's amazing. That's amazing to think about that. We got the internet for good and ill. We got all these amazing things. We don't always use them wisely, but we got a world of tomorrow. It just wasn't the one we thought we were going to get in the 1930s and 40s.
And in the world of today, the power of your smartphone is what you were living off of in the days immediately after the fire, I'm sure, that a smartphone was the lifeline to everything.
Very much so, with the caveat that the fire also destroyed a lot of cell phone towers. So it was depending on where you were, very difficult to use your phone. But your main point is absolutely right. As I mentioned in a fire story, this was a 21st century disaster. The first thing that happened after the fire is everybody set up Facebook groups for this neighborhood or that aid agency or this government group, which was wonderful for those of us who had access to the internet, but did nothing for those who were too poor or too old or just didn't have the resources to tap into the internet, got left further and further behind. So wonderful for those who could use it, including my family. But I think a bit of an unnecessary roadblock for those who couldn't access.
So a fire story starts out on Monday. My house disappeared. And you were a person, as all of your neighbors were, who lost their home in that was the Tubbs fire.
Mine was the Tubbs, right.
Yeah. And I thought it was amazing that your inclination was to buy pens and paper and to draw.
It was. And I think that might mean I'm not hooked up right. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's a character flaw. But the day after the fire, I went to a department store and I bought shoes because I'd evacuated in sandals. They were the first thing by the bed. I bought, the things you need. I bought a shirt and I bought some socks and I bought art supplies, which at this store were very poor. It was bad quality paper with a couple of black permanent markers and some four colored highlighters. And I started making this comic and I felt compelled to make the comic. I knew I'd borne witness to this extraordinary, really historical event. I was in the middle of it. And I just felt like I had to report on it. My first job out of college, I was a newspaper reporter, and this felt a lot like doing journalism to me. I don't want to be too overwrought about it, but it really felt like kind of a dispatch from the front lines of, a battle of some sort.
And as you were drawing and chronicling, then how did you posted this stuff on the web and it immediately goes viral?
It did, yeah. The web was really my only outlet. You talk about the power of the web and the world of tomorrow. I started posting these pages on the web within a few days of the fire. And I drew, I think, 16 or 18 pages within 3.5-4 days, which in addition to dealing with all the things you have to deal with when your house burns down is a pretty prodigious rate of production. And something like 700,000 people saw that in the first week or so. People who were here and had gone through the fire told me I got it right. People who were on the other side of the country and weren't here had seen it on the news, of course. They'd seen the mushroom cloud rising over the Sonoma Plains, but they said that my story was the first thing they'd seen that made them understand and feel like what it was like to be here. So those are the two reactions that that mean the most to me. That means my story did what I wanted it to do. So yeah, something like 700,000 people read it very soon. And then KQED emailed me. And their art director, Gabe Moline, emailed me and said, hey, would you mind if we took a crack at animating your – and I said, knock yourselves out. I wasn't planning on doing any animating. So they produced a short 6-minute film that they broadcast, they put online, got picked up by NPR, and another 2.5 or 3 million people saw that. So our story got out.
So how trippy was that for you to – be in the midst of buying shoes and underpants and then having KQED push this out to the world, and it subsequently won an Emmy.
It did win an Emmy Award for best current affairs feature story. It was weird in that the comic and the book and the fire story was not my high priority. It was something I did in my spare time. I was worried about things like insurance and, buying tools because I knew I'd need a shovel to go dig through my lot. And at the time, right after the fire, my wife, Karen, and I moved in with our daughters who share an apartment in Novato. So it was very strange to be dealing with all the things you have to deal with when your house burns down and also have camera crews coming to my daughter's apartment to interview me and put me on TV. I'm pretty sure the neighbors thought a murder had happened next door, because it was just bizarre. It was also a distraction. I mean, the book, the story, the comic was really just had to be pushed to the back of my mind. It wasn't the most important thing in my life right then.
And so now we have the publication of this Really beautifully published book, A Fire Story.
You know, I can't take any credit for that. I have to agree with you. It's published by Abrams Books, with the same publisher who did my previous two books. I worked with my same editor who edited my other two books, a man named Charlie Kochman, who's just the best editor ever. Had an excellent art director. I mean, Abrams makes really pretty books, and I'm as wowed as anybody with it.
And in the story, you highlight your own story and your wife and your daughters, but you also feature some other people's stories too. And I found that as interesting to have these snippets of other people's reflections that I think are so universal when thousands of people had this experience. And variations of a theme,
mm-hmm.
You know, insurance, no insurance, good insurance, bad insurance, got out with this, didn't get out with that. But essentially, it's a great equalizer. Well, I don't know that great is the word, but it is an equalizer.
It's a powerful equalizer.
Yes,
yeah.
And it is not discriminating.
Yeah. Well, when I set out to turn this 18-page webcomic into a 160-page printed book, I needed to expand the story. As I said, I felt like I was doing journalism, and I wanted to tell as comprehensive a story of this fire as I could, not just about me and my family over a week or two, but our community over a longer time. So I knew I needed to talk to other people because my experience was limited to mine. And so I interviewed many people. I put six of their stories in the book, their fire stories in their own words. It's text. I didn't illustrate them. They talked to me. I recorded it. I transcribed it. That's what's in the book. Very, very straightforward first-person reporting. And I love them. They're my favorite part of the book. Talk about commonality. I found some interesting things is that almost everybody I talked to when they left their homes, unless their home was actually on fire when they left it, they all thought they'd be back in 2 days. Nobody said 1 day. Nobody said 3 or 4 days. Everybody said, I thought I'd be back in 2 days, which is exactly what I thought. I packed two pairs of underwear and two pairs of socks, and I thought I'll be back, you know, day after tomorrow. That's a weird psychological thing to me. I don't know where that comes from. And another thing people commonly said to me, no matter what their position, rich or poor, fortunate or the least fortunate, they all said, I know a lot of people worse off than I am. And they just lost their homes. You know, who's worse off than that? But every single person, including my wife and I, knew people worse off. And we all did what we could to help the people worse off, even though we didn't really have any resources ourselves. I thought that was extraordinary.
It is quite something when you lose your home, yet it's the other losses of your neighbor's homes that is equally painful to see.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. And in fact, one of my neighbors, in her story's in the book, her name's Mary. And I actually called Mary on the phone and to be the one to tell her house had been destroyed because she didn't know that yet. And I told her, your house is gone. And she tells a story in the book of how, you know, that hit her. But when I told her the whole neighborhood was gone, that was just a blow to her heart. And I totally understand that. And as we rebuild, the nice thing about our neighborhood is most of our neighbors are coming back. And I just cannot wait until all those houses are rebuilt. And maybe a year or a year and a half from now, we're back together again. This community is made whole again. And that's unusual because a lot of neighborhoods just disintegrated. People couldn't afford to rebuild. They didn't want to rebuild. Wasn't worth the time or effort or trouble. And they've gone away. And the whole neighborhood is just evaporated. Ours is coming back, and it means the world to us.
Is this Mary of Mary and Larry?
Yes.
She said something that I think many people felt, that it was a challenge to feel worthy mm-hmm. of the generosity of others, and that you somehow don't feel that you're deserving of somebody else's compassion, even when you've lost everything.
Yeah. Well, I think that kind of circles back to the idea that you knew people worse off. We all did. What Mary realized is that, no, she did deserve it, and she needed to learn to graciously accept people's help and generosity, and so did I. You know, we had local restaurants give us free lunches. And we, oh, no, no, we don't need it. Don't worry. Give it to somebody who needs it. Well, we need it. Thank you for the free lunch. That's what you say. You say, thank you for the free lunch.
Yes.
And
yes.
But that's very hard to yes. accept that. And because, you know, nobody wants to feel like a charity case. Nobody wants to be pitied. I think that's the root of it. Nobody wants to be pitied. But sometimes you just have to accept people's kindness and take it with some grace, I think.
Yes. And so in the book, you illustrate your kind of trajectory of rediscovering your property. Then you show kind of your archaeological dig of your property, and that's what people did. It's like an archaeology dig or a forensic exercise in your life mm-hmm. that has been distilled down to just a foot or two of ash. Yet you find things emerge, a salt and pepper shaker,
yeah.
seemingly like you could use it.
It was in our case, literally an archaeological dig, because one of my daughters is an archaeologist. So she brought all the tools and she had a crew out there helping us. But the salt and pepper shaker was our miracle find. It was just two little ceramic salt and pepper shakers of my wife's grandparents from the 1920s or 30s, Art Deco. And they just landed, settled side by side, standing upright, right where our kitchen used to be. No damage at all. The only damage was their corks underneath had burned out. We probably won't use them because I'm sure they're full of ash and, you know, not safe for consumption. But they're beautiful, and we'll put them on a display case, and they will be our holy relics from our life before, you know.
Yes, it is amazing, and you do muse in the book at the power of this heat that can transform a major appliance into just a unrecognizable ribbon of metal.
Yeah. This fire did things I didn't understand fire could do. I had no concept. When we saw it, when we evacuated our house at 1:30 in the morning and saw this thing coming over the hills at us, I could not conceive of how it could possibly get into our subdivision. Just knowing the geography that was between it and us, I couldn't understand how it could possibly leap these clear areas and even get to us. And I assumed if it started getting in our neighborhood, the firefighters would, you know, form some valiant line and save our neighborhood. But of course, I didn't know there were firefighters scattered all over two counties in a 50-mile-long front. Nobody was going to save our neighborhood. It just wasn't possible. We didn't know that when we evacuated. But yeah, this fire driven by 50, 60, 70-mile-an-hour winds, I call it in the book a napalm tsunami, and it just dashed over those hills like a giant tidal wave of, you know, 2,500-degree heat, destroyed everything in its path, melted things that I didn't know could melt. I was struck by when we started digging down through our ashes. I knew I'd hit the native soil when I got to red because it had turned the iron in our soil to iron oxide in their clay soil. Our dirt had turned red. So, it was the worst possible kind of education.
I'm talking with Brian Fees, and his recently published book is A Fire Story, and it's a graphic memoir of his and his family's experience of the Tubbs Fire, losing their home and the aftermath of it. And there was something in there that struck me. It's what I call disaster tourism or voyeurism, where you were in your neighborhood on your property and saw somebody taking pictures. So why don't you talk a little bit about that sort of thing that was happening everywhere?
Yeah, it was happening everywhere. I interrupted a man who was taking photos of melted metal in my neighbor's front room, it turned out. He didn't know that, but it was my neighbor's old front room. And I interrupted him and stopped him and politely and firmly asked him to please get off my neighbor's property. It wasn't his place to be there. There was nothing to damage. There was nothing worth saving. Nobody could have hurt anything, but these were still kind of sacred spaces for us. These were our homes. And some people were a lot more sensitive about it than others. Some people didn't care who tromped through their stuff because it was all ash and there wasn't anything there they cared about anymore. But for other people, including, I think, my family, we wanted to go through it, and it was about 2 weeks before we could even get to the property, before the National Guard and police allowed us to get onto it. And we knew looters were getting there before us. We knew they were going through and pick. and doing all this stuff. And it was just, it was an obscenity. It was just so galling to be kept from our property that we knew other people were like walking on a grave kind of. So we looked out for each other. You know, I protected my neighbor's property. I know neighbors looked out for mine. Helpers, other responders, people who were there to lay wattles to control erosion or that kind of thing. They kept an eye out for our stuff too. I showed up to dig through my property one day and a fellow who was in charge of a jail work crew, guys in orange jumpsuits were there doing some environmental work. And he comes over and says, "Hey, you know, I noticed you had two steel cans of coins there in your driveway." And I'd found them and I'd taken them out. It was just pennies. It was two cans of pennies. And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, my crew noticed those cans of coins over there too, and I kept them away from them." And I said, that's so nice, you know. But I said, if anybody wants $5 worth of melted change, they can come get it. But I really appreciated that. We all looked out for each other in there. And by and large, in fact, without exception I can think of, everybody who came in there to work, sheriffs, firefighters, utility people, the dog catcher, everybody was just so solicitous, so thoughtful and careful about our feelings and respecting our property and trying to do anything they could not to make our lives harder.
And it was something that, and you do express it graphically in the book, that after the fire, though you did, just hours after your house burned down, manage to walk into
your
neighborhood.
I just walked in. It was so early.
Before they clamped down.
Yeah, it was before anybody put up any roadblocks even or were trying to stop anybody from getting in. They just hadn't organized it yet. So yeah. I walked in at about 7:30 the next morning, just 5 or 6 hours after my neighborhood was destroyed, and there was nobody there.
Just hours. Hours after you left your home, and you walk back in, and there's...
There was nothing.
It
was
nothing there.
Well, I had my hopes raised and then dashed because as I walked to my neighborhood, I walked through neighborhoods that looked perfectly good. There was nothing wrong with these neighborhoods. And I walked a little further and I see little trickles of smoke coming up on the horizon, but that didn't bother me much. And then I turned a little curve and what was ahead of me looked like a nuclear bomb had gone off. It was just a flat, sterile, gray plane of smoldering nothing. It was my neighborhood. As far as the eye could see, for a half mile of distance, my brain didn't quite know what to do with the information my eyes were giving it, you know, because everything was gone. You think of houses and redwood trees and things like that being so permanent, and it was gone in like 5 hours. It was just when I talk, you know, the very opening line of the book is, "On Monday, my house disappeared," and it felt like some evil magician had played a horrible trick on us because it was just gone. It's unbelievable.
And then you see on the television reporters in your neighborhood. I think that some people probably found out that they lost their homes because they saw it on TV.
Yeah.
Somebody reporting from their neighborhood.
Yep.
And so reporters and claims adjusters and all these other people are allowed into your neighborhood except the residents.
Right. Very frustrating, hugely frustrating. And I learned to make a little peace with that as I describe in the book where my wife and I were literally standing at a barricade just itching to get in and found out that, well, while I was there, you know, starting to rant about my rights as an American to get on my property, that search and rescue crews were at that very moment going house to house searching bed springs for human bones. They were looking for people who died in their sleep. And that sobers you up. That's, you know, my wife was right. She said they're just doing their jobs. They won't be there any longer than they need to. And she was right. And there was no reason to be there, but I needed to be there.
It's your home.
Yeah.
It's your home. And I don't want to end our conversation without mentioning your wife because she is portrayed in the book. And she also really stepped up and gave a lot in those hours after the fire. And why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
I am so impressed with her. I married so well, so far above my station. Yeah, my wife Karen is the director for Sonoma County Human Services. So immediately after the fire, as soon as we evacuated our house, we went to her office and she got on the phone and she started, first of all, trying to call employees in, which is very hard at 2 in the morning. most people have their phones off. Most people didn't know anything was wrong. They'd gone to bed 3 hours earlier, 4 hours earlier, thinking everything was just fine. So she's trying to activate these phone trees, get people into work. She knew the freeways were closed. So if she got hold of a worker in Petaluma who normally worked in Santa Rosa, she told him, don't come to Santa Rosa. Just go to Petaluma High School and open up a shelter. You know, if you live in Windsor, go to Windsor High School, open up a shelter. You're in charge of that shelter. That was not their job yesterday, but it became their job today. So she's you know, kind of commanding this army of social workers who don't know what, you know, they weren't ready for this 6 hours earlier. She also has a role in the county's emergency response office. She was planning evacuations of the Valley of the Moon Children's Home just in real time. She was on the phone with people who were there at the site, and they're telling her it's surrounded by flames on three sides, and she's helping them map how to get these kids out of there, these foster children out of this home, which she did successfully. It was just astonishing to hear her to sit in her office uselessly while she did her part to help save whatever of the county she could. And even after she found out that her home was destroyed, she just stayed on duty. You know, she just kept going like so many people did. We had, you know, cops and firefighters in our neighborhood, around the corner, around the block, who lost their homes and knew they lost their homes and still just worked a week straight without rest because that was who they were and what they did.
And are the two of you soon moving into your rebuilt home?
I hope so. Yeah. We jumped on it quick because we knew there'd be a lot of people wanting to rebuild, when we knew we wouldn't be able to get concrete and lumber and labor, and all of that was true and remains true. So we jumped on it quickly. We decided, almost without discussing it, that we were going to rebuild just because we loved our neighborhood. We loved our neighbors. We couldn't think of anywhere we'd rather be. So if all goes well, we'll be in our new house in a few weeks.
Well, very good. Very good. Brian Fees, thank you for telling your story and the way you've told your story. It's a fire story.
Oh, thank you so much.
Brian Fees, author, illustrator, and survivor. His book is A Fire Story. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Our show today is all about resilience and about community, and I always aim to present you with conversations that open our experience with each other. I invite you to support our radio community by joining us online at norcalpublicmedia.org. Go to radio and click on the button that says Donate. Thanks for being the public in public radio. R.L. Rotary grew up in an unstable home, moving 17 times in nearly as many years. And she suffered repeated sexual abuse and violent treatment from her father. After becoming a mother herself and well into adulthood, Rotary sought to overcome the fear and insecurity these early life experiences left her with. Her memoir, The Little Girl Next Door, is candid and direct, but also filled with the wonder of a curious child and the strength and kindness of an open and loving adult. Here is our conversation.
R.L. Rotary is the author of The Little Girl Next Door. Welcome into the studio today, and I'll tell our listeners that that's your pen name. So I'll say welcome, Dio.
Thank you, Suzanne.
And we're here to talk about your memoir, The Little Girl Next Door, which is the story of your childhood and your family life when you were growing up. And I will say that it was a very tough read for me, because your book is all about, or mostly about, the physical and sexual abuse you suffered as a child, primarily at the hands of your father. And I felt such a sense of shock and sadness reading the book, yet there was this lightness coming through into the darkness that was also very, very present as well. So set this up for us and tell us why you approached this memoir and how you approached writing about your childhood?
Just to let you know, it took me many years to read it all the way through myself. It is a very tough read. It is a story that I felt I needed to share in hopes of helping other people that have gone through a situation like this know that you can live through it, the memories of it again. What happened to me is when I had my child 28 years ago, I had incest memories pop up in like films and dreams, and I thought I was going crazy. My dad at that time was very sick with cancer and was dying, and we were taking care of him. I had this deep desire not to let him meet my daughter, which I felt was rather cruel on my part, but I really needed to protect her, and I wasn't sure what from. So as the memories popped up, I found a therapist, and we started working in sessions very rigorously. And a lot of what you do in those sessions is, as the memories pop up, you relive them. And the main thing that she told me that really saved me through this was that I've survived them the first time and I will survive them the second time. So the second time I was able to empower myself with parenting myself, knowing that it wasn't my fault, understanding the other roles in my family and the situations that happened with them. And I started writing parts of this book as therapy. I kept a journal. I drew some of the pictures that are in the book, and it was to help me through my recovery period, I call it. So eventually I ended up probably 10 years later thinking, you know, I should maybe write this and make this a book. You know, maybe this could help someone out besides myself. And so I planned to write a page a day and figured I'd have 365 pages in a year. And it took me about 4 or 5 years to get that done. And I put it away for quite a while. And, you know, the Me Too movement just started up. I had no plans of this being part of it. But one of the things I find with the Me Too movement is children don't really have a voice to be able to say, hey, you know, Me Too, this happened to me. When they're children, we usually have these memories as we get to be adults. So some of these things that happened to me, you know, if people see things or in their gut, they feel things, you know, I am my gut. I have a very good intuition. I think a lot of survivors do. I know when a parent in my daughter's class with their kids, I know things are going on that aren't okay. You know, maybe if we can speak up and do something to help children along the way before, you know, they end up being adults. And there were a lot of things that happened to me in my adulthood that were a result of what happened. And I've been able to work through a lot of those and become a more productive, happier in myself person.
I am really stunned by just some of the statistics that I've read about with regard to child sexual abuse. Now, of course, it's in the news a lot with priests and that legacy. But, you know, there are statistics that are like 1 out of every 3 girls or 1 out of every 7 girls and maybe 1 out of every 15 boys experience some kind of sexual abuse before the age of 18. And that most often that is by a family member. And I think that that is just so shocking to many of us, that that kind of family relationship can be so betrayed. But more so that we are building this kind of legacy now. And we can get into some of the details of your story in a minute. But very often, the parent, the individual, the uncle, the person who is abusing their young charge has themselves experienced brutality in their childhood. And that kind of legacy seems to be something that maybe people like you who are speaking out and others who are speaking out are helping to stop that legacy.
I agree. You know, the statistics, I don't like to get bogged down in them. It was interesting. I was driving here today and I was thinking, I have several friends that I've given the book to that haven't read it, and they know me and they know what it's about, and they don't want to experience the pain and read it. And I respect that. They're my friends and I love them. They're dear people. But I think sometimes society or people put their head in the sand and choose not to believe that it happens because it is so horrific. And I think that's enabling the perpetrators to get away with it more. I did some research for some of one of the parts in my book, the hospital scene, and I called and asked a man to dig through files in the basement of the hospital I was in at that time. And he did. And he worked a graveyard, and he came in and he sent me the files. So I was able to read my reports and, you know, interesting words in my doctor report that I was very agitated and that I was very afraid and that I was very scared. And I was a pretty self-confident little kid. I was, almost 4 years old. And just the words and the choices of the words, it also confirmed that I was in a suite in a building by myself, where the person was able to come in and do what they did. And also a woman that I talked to there that confided in me that she had been date raped in college. And she said, "I've never told anyone that." And she probably will never tell anyone else that. But she felt confident enough when you're amongst people like yourself, the survivors, where you can say something like that. And it kind of releases the power of it and acknowledges that it wasn't okay and that it wasn't your fault.
And that's the strength of and the fear maybe of what we're going through at this moment in our culture, of talking about this more. And I think we have to face the reality of this and the incredulity of it, that I think for those of us who haven't experienced, there's maybe even more fear about that this is really happening and maybe don't know how to approach victims and survivors. And since you brought up your early experience, so you had a family life and an angry dad who took it out on his children, and you had a loving grandmother who has stayed with you this entire time and maybe provided some of the fabric of strength in your life. But at a young age, you went to the hospital, as you just mentioned, for a tonsillectomy and experienced your first episode of being abused by an adult. And is that something that you then suppressed as a child? But it seems like there was a subsequent time when you were examined by a doctor and that maybe they discovered evidence of that and expressed it to your father. And then it was after that that your father started abusing you. It just seemed like a very strange situation with your dad, maybe even possessing this knowledge. What are your some reflections on that?
The hospital incident, I was about 2 weeks away from being 4 years old, so I was pretty young. It's the first time I remember anything, so I'm not sure that was the first time there was an assault. It's the first time I remembered. I did remember at that time frame taking baths at home and feeling uncomfortable when Dad came in, but I didn't remember anything specific. At that time, a man took me in a room and he hurt me, told me he was giving me a shot. So really, the only evidence I have as an adult is I have always been terrified of hospitals. I go in and I have a panic attack. I have no idea why. So when this memory came up and I was able to live through it, when I say live through it, you go through it and you realize what really happened. There's a lot of things that shut down and, you know, I thought I got a shot and it hurt. I didn't get a shot. So the memory of that and reliving that, one of the exercises we did was, what if I was I told my mom a man hurt me, and she said, "Oh, it hurts in the hospital." And she had a baby in her arms and was pregnant. And, you know, I tried to walk out of the hospital. So she was very upset at the staff for letting me try to walk out of the hospital. So the memories as an adult, skipping forward into that and being afraid of the hospital, today I can go into a hospital. If I get afraid, I understand. I embrace that little girl and I say, "I'm protecting you." So some of the reliving we did in therapy was, what would I do if I walked in and saw that? Well, my first thought is I would kill the man. What would that do for me as a little child? I would lose my mother too. I would have been abused and I would not have a mother. So reporting the man, telling him, "Stop, no, that's bad," and then taking me away and taking care of that situation is a more mature, grown-up way to parent. One of the things as a parent myself is I will never leave my child alone in the hospital. And that's okay for me. And I suggest that highly to people, that to be careful of caregivers. The caregivers that want to are abuse children or that have to or whatever their reason is, they end up around children. And it's not all people around children, but, you've got to go where, the hunting's good, for lack of a nice way to say it. So later on, the injury when I was in first grade, I loved going to baseball games. My dad was a minor league player. It was great to go. Got to be with all the guys, and, I love sports. And, that incident in the hospital where they found out that, I might have been abused already. The first time I remember with my dad, I was maybe a year after that of specific abuse happening.
What do you think your dad, that he not only sexually abused you and your other sister, and I don't know about your brothers, mm-hmm. The way you wrote in the book, it wasn't graphic, but there were some times I thought, oh, that's what she's talking about. And in the book, you almost have the voice of that young girl puzzling through things. So I thought it was an interesting way of telling your story in the book. But your dad seemed to try to provide for his family, but at the same time, you had a very unstable life. You were always moving around, and he had a temper that he really did inflict a lot of brutality on you guys. And yet, your mother seems to be a person who, in the book, you make it sound like she was somebody who helped you feel safe or brought you beauty. But she also seemed to sometimes maybe thump you a little bit or antagonize you or frustrate you that way. And how could your mother have not really known what was going on?
Well, let's see. My mother, I adored her. I was afraid for her often. I didn't really realize that maybe till I got older. But, I waited for her to come home. I panicked. She was who I saw as a strong person in our family. There are reasons, therapeutic-wise, why the parent of the other parent doesn't do anything. Sometimes it's to take the pressure off of them. They've probably been abused themselves. There's situations like that. Later in life, when my dad did have cancer, and I was able to sit down and not be afraid and ask him, why did you do what you did to us when we were kids in our life? And I didn't specifically say the abuse, but why were you so angry? Why did you hit us so much? Why did you do these things? And he just cried and looked at me and goes, I did the best I could. I didn't do any of those things. I didn't do anything wrong. So, there is a point where, and I know that he explained to me situations in his childhood that were pretty bad. My mom also explained those too. So I'm pretty sure, judging from his brothers and sisters and my cousins and things like that, that there is, a family pattern that goes on here. And it's all very hidden and hush-hush, and there's outcomes of the children that are pretty indicative of people that have been through abuse. So, I think in his mind, when a perpetrator does what they do, they become the child that they were when they were abused themselves. So they become children, and it's a power thing. They're trying to gain their power back. It's really actually not about the sexual act. So it's all understanding that and learning that and being able to analyze that in my own mind helps me understand more. Because for many years after I moved out of the house, my mom passed away when I was 12. And many years after I moved out of the house, I was angry, and I drank abusively for 10 years and then got into recovery. And I think the drinking probably saved my life at that point. When I left home, I didn't really know how to cope with the world. I really wasn't given the skills that I needed. I didn't think my childhood was bad. I thought we had some hard times. I lost my mom. My dad remarried some very inappropriate stepmoms, and, you know, it was kind of hard. I eventually learned that my mom wasn't perfect and forgave her for that, and was able to see her part in it and understand that, again, that it wasn't my fault. You know, I did a lot of holding the family together as the oldest child. I took care of them. I took care of my siblings. You know, I was the fixer and the responsible child and the enabler. I was very, very, very busy. I was very tired by the time I was 17. So I think that situation, with my mom, you know, there was a time in third grade or fourth grade when I came out of the shower with my dad, and my mom looked at me like she was very upset at me, like I had done it. You know, so and then being set up a few times in situations where there was violence with neighbors and things like that. But on the outside, you know, we were, you know, the two boys, two girl family with the mom and dad. And we were the poor white Christian family in a small town in the Midwest. And we were respected. We cleaned the church. Mom was in choir. I was the acolyte. I had good grades, things like that. So, you know, if we could have hit it that well, you know it's happening in a lot of other places.
Yes, yes. And as you mentioned, you were this family of active kids, and you often had a menagerie of animals around you. At one point, your family moves to a place called Camp Rotary, and it seems like that might have been the happiest time in your life, perhaps. And these good times, good spells, were often marked, though, with outbursts by your dad, or it seems like all of you children knew, or at least you did, what might set your dad off. And he wasn't, he was heavy into corporal punishment to the point of broken arms, broken legs, and severe beatings. And maybe your family would get into a groove that was good for the kids, but he would pick you up and move you someplace else where you had to make new friends and go to a new school. And it seemed like you managed to do well in school and get good grades. You eventually made it out here to California, and your family settled out here in California for a while at least. And I just was struck by that instability, yet your ability to find the newness and maybe even adventure in it.
I look back and I was very resilient. I was very creative. When we moved out here to California after my mom passed away, my father moved us out here to be near his sister. One of the great adventures is we lived in San Rafael when the Civic Center was being built, and I was able to crawl up on the roof and watch the, I think it was two lanes each way freeway go by, the cars go by, and I would, you know, smoke a few of his cigarettes. I didn't inhale them, but I thought it was being pretty cool. We made rafts in the lakes. There wasn't really a lake there yet, but there was a lot of water that was there. We did a lot of adventures through there. I could go sit at the dock of the bay and literally listen to that song and play it on my little radio and sing it, you know, and I miss my mom a lot. And California was very strange to me. You had sun and you had rain, and it was very unusual weather. I wasn't real sure I liked that. And then we moved to Roanoke Park, and my dad bought a 7-acre farm, and he knew nothing really about farming, so I got to have the acreage. So I made friends with my neighbors and made deals for them to grow hay on 3 acres, and I got a bale of it, and I saved up enough money to buy a horse. And the lady that sold me the horse helped me learn about horses. I joined 4-H. I changed the chicken coop into a barn. I found people to board horses there, so I had money. I gave kids lessons on the horse and charged them $10 an hour, and their parents loved dumping them off for a Saturday.
And how old were you at the time?
I was
14?
13 or 14. Yeah, I was about 7th and 8th grade.
I'm speaking with R.L. Rotary. The book is The Little Girl Next Door, and R.L. Rotary is the pen name of Dio Deneau. Just what you're talking about, some of the vignettes we're talking about, peppered through the book are the delightful stories of a child growing up in these environments. But each chapter also has a searing quality to it as well. The very title of your book, The Little Girl Next Door, to me indicates that there's a lot right in front of us that we maybe don't know or understand. And you've revealed this to us in a very personal memoir that I hope we can all learn from, but also that it helps others who might be experiencing something or have experienced something. What do you tell those people?
Other people have gone through it, and that you can change the behaviors yourself that may be a result of what has happened to you. I don't continue the abuse. When I see other people, a lot of times people that have been abused attract the abuser. I can sit in a room with 200 people and one person that is sitting next to me won't feel comfortable. I had no idea I could get up and change my seat. Someone had to teach me that. So I get up and I change my seat. I don't have to keep myself in that situation. So one of the things I talk about in my books, I panicked at dinner, going out to dinner. There was abuse at the dinner table. So being able to go up to the dinner table and say, "And Dad, you're not invited to this meal. You may leave now." And then I don't have to, incorporate that behavior or those feelings. And so I say to those people, I'm here for you. I would like to hug you all and tell you it's going to be okay. It's really important to take care of yourself and to not beat yourself up. I guess that's my message, is embrace those little kids and the fact that we live through things and that, the skills we've learned. We've learned a lot of really great skills by dealing with that. And, one of the things I'm very proud of is, I have a daughter and she went to the same school and she's lived in the same city her whole life. So, she didn't have to move 17 times and go to 17 different schools and not have a set of friends. I met 3 different people at each school, and I always thought they were the same people, and they just came with me. So I had a lot of very good, vivid imagination stories going in my head, which today I choose to write. I love to write. I'm actually looking to write a next book, and it's a comedy. So there you go. There's how you recover from this.
We hope you'll come back when you finish that work. Ruth L. Rotary, R.L. Rotary, the pen name for D.O. Deneau, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Suzanne.
My conversation with author and survivor R.L. Rotary, with her memoir, The Little Girl Next Door. Earlier, we heard from Brian Fees with his graphic memoir, A Fire Story. You can hear me regularly on KRCB on the first and fifth Sunday of the month. Subscribe to our podcast at norcalpublicmedia.org, where you can also find our past shows. I have production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. I am Suzanne Lang. Thank you for listening. It is a novel idea.